From WKNOW, this is Steve Chanley with One Question Too Many. Today's program is made possible by the law firm of Employer Advocates Group, serving California employers since 2002, with offices in Orange County and San Luis Obispo County, California. EAGlawgroup.com. We're joined today by Raymond L. Wheeler. He was a longtime senior partner at Morrison & Forster, where he practiced labor and employment law his entire career. He was the chair and co-chair of the firm's labor and employment practice group. Ray is a charter fellow in the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers and is a member of the National Advisory Board of the Berkeley Journal of Employment and Labor Law. Thanks for joining us today, Ray.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So you're retired now, right?
I am, as for now, for 10 years. Hard to believe, but I retired in 2015.
Now, I know that you're a proud Texan and you graduated from the University of Texas at Austin before attending Harvard Law School. What did you study at Texas?
Well, at Texas, when I was applying to go there, they had just launched a liberal arts program that they called Plan 2 for some reason, which was designed to compete with Ivy League and other top schools. And so I was offered a place in it, and we got the top professors and went through a program with largely the same people. But during my 4 years there, I focused on history especially, but also English, philosophy, and political science.
Did you get a chance to go to many of the Longhorns games?
Go Horns. I definitely did. When I was there, they were really good.
In fact, I think one of the years they went 10-1 during the season and beat Alabama in the Orange Bowl.
That's true, Steve. In fact, to elaborate a bit on that, Texas was ranked number 5 going into the Orange Bowl, and Alabama was ranked number 1. And Alabama had a quarterback that some people might know, Joe Willie Namath. And Texas won in the Orange Bowl. But my first year was even better, because I started at Texas in 63, and they went undefeated that season. And they played number 2 Navy in the Cotton Bowl, and Navy was led by Roger Staubach. I was able to go to that game and see Texas hammer them 28-6. And then, nice. Then they lit up the tower, or infamous tower at Texas, some people know from the Whitman shootings, in a big orange one. So it was pretty great experiences back then, going to the Texas football games.
I can sense just a little bit of pride there.
Yes, I'd say more than a little bit.
When did you know that you wanted to study the law?
I was thinking about this a little bit, and I think it went back to a job I had in the summers during high school when I'd have to go find a job in Denton, Texas, where I lived, which was a very small town. And following the advice of my mother, who said, if you can type, you'll always be able to get a job. I had taken typing, and I got a job at a title insurance company, typing index cards of documents filed in the county courthouse, like deeds of trust and deeds, for the purposes of title searches. And we were located inside the county clerk's office, and so I'd see the lawyers come and go. I'd hear all the lawyer gossip. I was right in the middle of what the legal scene was like, albeit pretty small potatoes in Denton. And I got very interested in the law then.
It's interesting. Just a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed a court of appeal judge, and what led him to a career in law was being a jailer right out of high school.
Well, the jail wasn't far away from where we were, but it was more seeing the ladies in the county clerk's office and the lawyers come and go, and then when they would leave, all the gossip about them. So it's kind of funny how you develop an interest in such things. But I had that job for 3 or 4 summers, and then I actually ended up doing it one summer in Austin when I moved there. So it was a good job and really did put me into understanding a little bit about property law anyway.
I'm going to be using a term, traditional labor law, during our conversation. Would you tell our listeners what that term means and how it differs from what is referred to today generically as employment law?
Okay. Traditional labor law pretty much was the universe of labor law when I started out. It really was the only course taught in law schools, and it's what was being practiced by labor lawyers back then when I started out. Basically, what that is the law governing relationships between management and unions regulated under the National Labor Relations Act and its amendments like the Taft-Hartley Act. And, you know, it involves union organizing efforts, unfair labor practice litigation, collective bargaining, strikes and picketing, and so forth. And the primary agency regulating all this was the National Labor Relations Board. Beyond that, non-union companies, ones that were lucky not to have unions, didn't worry too much about employment law when I started out, other than payroll rules and overtime pay and things like that. But that began to change right about the time I started practicing law. And I think the first major change was that Title VII of the 64 Civil Rights Act was amended in 1970 to provide a private right of action. And not long after that, we started to see discrimination cases being filed, clients worrying about discrimination, and then even class actions. And then a little further along in the time frame, employment law really became the term that was used to describe employment lawyers, because especially with the development of wrongful discharge theories led in California, like most other good or bad ideas, and at least initially, that was considered to be a tort cause of action, and that was premised on the concept of discharge without cause. That brought into play whether the employer might have breached its personnel rules, which were then being treated as contractual, which meant that every employer everywhere had to worry about how its personnel policies and procedures were written. And so employment law became a very big deal for a lot of companies at that time. So traditional law, labor law, still was going on with unions and all of that, but the vast majority of companies that didn't have unions now needed employment lawyers.
Wasn't Archibald Cox your labor law professor while you were at Harvard?
He was. He had a lot to do with me deciding to become a labor lawyer. His class was the one that I enjoyed the most when I was in law school. I mean, he was first place. He was kind of an icon. He had been Solicitor General during the Kennedy administration. And then he's best known by most people as the Watergate special prosecutor who was summarily discharged in the Saturday Night Massacre. This all came after I was there, but his academic chops had been in constitutional law and even more so in labor law. And if you were reading articles in the field of labor law back then, you would find that the leading ones were written by Archibald Cox, and he had the leading textbook in the area, Cox and Bach on labor law. And I got into his course, and I was really fascinated by the policy issues that drive traditional labor law back then, you know, how to regulate relationships between union and management, and the fact that the thrust of the law really is to, while there are ground rules, let management and union fight it out, and the free flow of economic power basically decides how their relationships, if any, get structured. And then things like the rules of the road, like secondary boycotts and picketing rules and things like that. Anyway, I was just really interested in that because it seemed very real world and, you know, workers, management, how the law dealt with that. So it really interested me. And then maybe because I got my highest grade ever at law school in that course, caused me to think, well, maybe this is something I really should pursue. And so my third year, I took a course writing a third year paper for Derek Bach, who was the co-author of the Cox and Bach on Labor Law, and he ultimately became president of Harvard. So I was really exposed to some of the giants of the field and did really well, probably because I had a lot of interest in that area of the law. And so I was on the lookout for labor law jobs as I was moving towards graduation.
Upon graduation from law school, you did a one-year clerkship with Justice Irving Goldberg in the Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal. Did your clerkship prepare you for the law practice that you would later have?
It really did, and it gave me an insight, you know, how cases are decided, what good lawyering is. And I would also say it was maybe one of the best jobs I ever had, because Judge Goldberg really involved his clerks in helping him write and make decisions. Literally, we were always dealing with him every day. He very much involved his clerks. The other thing about it is we were there during the desegregation efforts going on in the South following the Brown versus Board of Education case. And the Fifth Circuit was really at the forefront of all of that. It covered all of the South at that time. It was bigger then than it is now. It covered Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. And Judge Goldberg gave me all the constitutional cases to work on, which was terrific. So I got a lot of very interesting cases, and I got to meet some of the, what I would call, lions of the Fifth Circuit. Back then, Albert Tuttle, John Minor Wisdom, Homer Thornberry, Griffin Bell, John R. Brown. In fact, there's a book written about those times called about the judges on the Fifth Circuit called Unlikely Heroes by Jack Bass. And one of my prized mementos from that year is a copy of that book that's autographed by several of those judges. So it was a terrific job. I learned how to write effective briefs by seeing what was ineffective. I learned how the federal judicial process works. And it certainly improved my writing and analytical skills enormously, because I was writing opinions that were going to be seen by all these other judges as well as mine. And also because of what the Fifth Circuit was up to, I was in a position really to help contribute to some of the evolution of the law back then, especially breaking down some of the segregationist barriers in the South. I got to work on some of the very early Title VII cases that are still being cited. So it was a pretty heady experience.
Didn't you have the pleasure of meeting Justice Thurgood Marshall in a social setting while you were a clerk for Judge Goldberg?
I did. One of the things he did with his clerks is allow us to go to one judicial conference meeting or one oral argument, you know, in New Orleans. And so it so happened that one of these events, Justice Marshall was there, and Judge Goldberg and Justice Marshall and a few other judges went out to dinner, and I got to go along. So I spent an evening with Justice. I sat really close to him and spent an evening with him, listening to him recount tales.
I've read and heard from those who knew him that Justice Marshall was quite a storyteller. Did you see any of that when you met him?
I definitely did. I don't remember all the details, but he was hilarious because he regaled us with stories of his Senate confirmation hearings, where he was being questioned by Southern Democratic segregationist senators then in the Senate, like James Eastland, who is chair of the Judiciary Committee, Sam Ervin, Strom Thurmond, John McClellan, Herman Talmadge. And he talked about Strom Thurmond questioning him gave him over 60 questions, where he was quizzing him on minor aspects of the history of assorted constitutional provisions. I can't remember what they were, but I do remember imitating Strom Thurmond and his accent and how he asked questions. I was in stitches. He's a very funny guy. And of course, he was an icon to me when I met him, because of all he had done to bring about Brown versus Board. And he'd been Solicitor General under Johnson. But he's a heck of a storyteller.
clerkship, you started your career at Morrison and Forster in San Francisco to practice labor law.
Yes.
What drew you to Morrison and Forster, which was halfway across the country?
Well, it's another one of those serendipitous things, really. I told you that during law school, I developed this interest in labor law. And I was also trying to figure out where to go for a summer clerkship. So I interviewed with a lot of firms that came to Harvard from a lot of different cities. And I was sort of weighing in my mind whether to stay in Texas or branch out. And so San Francisco sounded like a nice place. So I looked into the firms that were interviewing from there. And one of them that really attracted me was Morrison and Forster, or better known now as MOFO. I liked it because it wasn't too big. It had 40 or so lawyers, but they did have a labor practice, unlike many other firms. And to top it off, the firm had sent Jim Paris, who became my ultimate mentor, to interview when he was an associate. He had only recently joined MOFO from the National Labor Relations Board, where he had a pretty senior position. And we talked during the interview about his idea of building a world-class labor department. And it was an unusual firm in the sense that its labor practice went almost all the way back to the Wagner Act, which established the National Labor Relations Board. They had a partner named J. Hart Clinton. And he had two or three major labor clients for whom he did work. They were in the beet sugar industry, the warehouse industry, dealing with the Teamsters and the ILWU, which was the West Coast version of a longshoremen's union, Harry Bridges, for those who know the history of labor relations, he dealt with him. So I was really taken by MOFO. But for some inexplicable reason that I can't understand today, I decided to accept a summer clerkship in the summer of 69 with an L.A. firm. It had a lot of entertainment industry clients and one labor partner who did labor issues, but it really wasn't going to be a place to end up. So I stayed in touch with Jim Paris and went up to San Francisco at the end of that L.A. summer. Got to get a good view of the Haight-Ashbury district, by the way. And I managed to wrangle a second summer clerkship after I graduated from Harvard, before I started the clerkship with Judge Goldberg. And I really enjoyed that clerkship. It was great. All I did was do employment law, labor law then, working solely with Jim. And so when I went back and started working with Judge Goldberg, he put the big rush on me to stay in Texas. He could never understand why I wanted to be a labor lawyer. But I decided to take the leap. And MOFO at that point was kind of the obvious place to go. So while I left Texas, that was a big step for me. But of course, as you know, Steve, Texas is a state of mind. So you never leave it totally. And I drove across country to San Francisco, thinking I would be there. Well, I'll give it a try and see how it works out. And it worked out for about 43 years.
That's a good run.
Yeah. Either that or I have no imagination to look into something else. But it was great. I was lucky because you never know.
You mentioned that Jim Paris was one of your mentors early in your career. How would you describe his approach to training young attorneys?
It was learn by observing. There were three associates that were, when I joined MOFO, there were three of us who were working for Jim, and J. Hart Clinton had just retired. This was before billable hours became the king. So I would tag along with him. Whenever he would talk to a client on the phone, I would be sitting in his office. I was pretty much involved in everything he was doing on matters he had assigned to me, including just being a note taker, going to collective bargaining and taking notes. But he was also very demanding yet fair. I quickly learned that if he gave me a research assignment, I better not go into his office to discuss it unless I was thoroughly prepared. I guess this kind of fits in with the name of your podcast, because he would always ask one question too many of me, where I hadn't thought through the answer. And I learned pretty quickly that was not a great feeling, so I better always have the answers. It was actually an apocryphal story of one of our associates who I'll let remain nameless, but he went on to be a very well-regarded labor lawyer in Fort Worth. But his grilling by Jim was so intense that he sweated up one of Jim's nice chairs in his office, and they had to have it cleaned. So it was, you had to be prepared. I don't know that that's possible to do these days in a lot of firms, because billable hours weren't being tracked with rigor then. There weren't computer billing sheets. And he could take me along even though he wasn't billing my time. And I think it was like the best of all worlds. And Jim was also a guy that liked to give as much responsibility as he thought you could take. And as he got more confidence in me, he turned me loose to do more. He didn't hoard clients. He seemed happy whenever a client would call me instead of him. So it was just all around, I think, the way to mentor somebody. He will be a good model.
Tell us about the nature of your law practice during, say, your first 5 years of your career.
Apart from a brief detour into Nixon's ill-fated 1971 wage and price controls, which somehow got assigned to our group because I guess it involved wages. And so I had to become an expert on price controls, and that was useful information for about 2 years, and then it just got flushed down the rabbit hole. But other than that, we're pretty much totally focused in the very first few years on traditional labor law, except for the occasional discrimination case. And this was really a great time to be working with Jim Paris, because in the late 70s, unions were making an effort to insert themselves into the emerging tech industry that began to proliferate in Silicon Valley, or what's known as Santa Clara Valley then, but later became known as Silicon Valley. And Jim had a very good relationship with Fairchild Semiconductor. And I don't know if your listeners would know the history of this, but Fairchild was a big company. Its operations in Santa Clara Valley were basically set up by this group of engineers who were called the Traitorous Eight. They had been working at Shockley Semiconductors for William Shockley, who was a bit of a tough guy to work for. So people like Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore and Jerry Sanders, they went to Fairchild. And after a while at Fairchild, they've got bristled a bit at the bureaucracy of it. And so they went off in different directions. And that's why Fairchild's called the mothership of Silicon Valley, because Intel was formed by those people, Advanced Micro Devices, Intersil, other companies like that. And because of Jim's relationship with Fairchild, they came to him when these unions were coming at them. And specifically, we did a lot of work for Intel. And because the International Association of Machinists were trying to organize Intel, as well as National Semiconductor and Memorex, we represented all of those three companies. And he involved associates in helping him do this, and because there were very few of us. So just as an example, at Intel, in order to deal with the question of what's the appropriate bargaining unit, we had to go over to the plant, take plant tours, see what the workflow was. We were interviewed supervisors. Jim called this a penetration analysis to try to determine not only legal issues about a workflow and appropriate bargaining unit, but what were the issues that the union was playing on and what might be useful in beating the union back if we ended up having to run a campaign, which we did for a number of years in the mid to late 70s. We're really doing quite a number of these. IAM and Teamsters and others were trying to organize the Valley. On every place we handled the matter, we won. The unions were unable to organize these emerging tech companies, and they remain non-union to this day. You know, there are people who write about the history of the Valley that say that the fact that these companies were able to remain non-union really had a lot to do with the rise of Silicon Valley. So we had a small part to play in all of that. On the Title VII side, I was exposed to that as the 70s moved along. We started getting class actions for many large companies. And there were only, at that point, there were seven associates working at that time. I had become a partner in 1976. So Jim and I were the two partners, although I was really junior. So the seven of us who were working really under Jim called ourselves the Magnificent Seven, because we pretty much lived and breathed our work, learning as we went along, because we were all pretty young. But it was a pretty heady time to be practicing labor and employment law in San Francisco.
Were you able to get a lot of early trial practice in defending unfair labor practice cases before the NLRB?
Yes, especially on some of these board cases where the hearing was focused on appropriate bargaining unit. In some of our bigger cases, we had to help handle those cases. And also because we had some union clients that, as I mentioned, we've had a number of clients that go back way, way back, that once J.R. Clinton, who had those clients, retired, well, they gravitated to Jim. And so companies like the beet sugar industry, we represented some grocery stores. That meant that we handled arbitrations under their collective bargaining agreements. And so once he felt like we were able to handle them, because, you know, there's small stakes involved, but they're really interesting, I was able to do that too. So that was litigation. It definitely was litigation. It's much different from civil litigation. But after 5 or 6 years, I was doing that.
Do you find NLRB litigation to be more fun than typical civil litigation because of the absence of pretrial discovery?
Oh, boy, did I. I loved doing arbitrations and board hearings. I felt it really tested you as a litigator. You had to be quick on your feet, but they were small matters, and you could put them together in a pretty short order, get a decision not too far down the road, and you didn't have to wait for some judge to decide. So you'd take facts, you'd assemble them, put together a coherent story with no discovery. You had to be prepared to cross-examine witnesses that you didn't even know who they were going to be until they were there. You couldn't do that. You couldn't do these cases. I really liked doing that because I just felt like it tested me and made me have to be quick to react.
Could you explain to our listeners what the Jenks rule is and how that rule works in the NLRB?
Sure. It comes from the Jenks Act, which is an old criminal statute that was, generally speaking, adopted by the board, that procedure. It means that the board had to provide documents made or created by the witness after they testify on direct examination so that I or whoever's the cross-examiner can cross-examine. And so the way it would work is, in a board proceeding, after the witness testifies, you would always ask whether the witness had made or created any written documents and ask that they be produced. This usually took the form of an affidavit that they might have given to the board. And so you would then ask for time to review it, which usually was a very short time, like sometimes 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then you would proceed with cross. So at least we got the documents. The board tried to resist the Jenks procedure for a while, but by the time I got there, it was pretty well established. So you could get it, but you wouldn't get it in advance.
So you're still required to think on your feet a great deal.
Yeah. Speed read the affidavit and prepare and think about how you're going to use it in cross-examination. Obviously, it means you've got to think about this a lot before you go into the board trial, but you don't really know what's in that affidavit because they will not turn it over until after the witnesses testified. So for sure, it was the same as in the arbitrations where you didn't even have that. But you had to think on your feet very quickly, think how you're going to cross, and not ask the one question too many also, as we've talked about here a bit.
That's my central tenet.
I know.
In the 70s and 80s, MOFO had a reputation for being a very progressive firm and perhaps one that might be considered, quote unquote, politically liberal today. Was there any friction within the firm because of the work that the Labor Department did in concentrating on, quote unquote, anti-union work?
A little bit, but one advantage we had is that the labor practice was actually, when I started, a separate department, and there was a long history of doing this work. Now, not a long history of doing discrimination work, but a long history of doing labor law work. And so I think that helped us in that we were an established part of the firm. It had some impact on recruiting, trying to convince top-notch lawyers that you were not an evil person if you came and worked for a management labor firm. We try to convince them that if you work for us, you're in a position to really affect compliance with the law, bring your clients to the right decision, make sure things are done correctly. And so, you know, for the most part, we could recruit with convincing, we could get the best people to come work for us.
During your career, you were very active with the American Bar Association, specifically its section on the development of the law under the National Labor Relations Act. How did that come about?
Well, it's interesting. I think towards the end of the 70s, I saw a flyer come in because I had joined the ABA, and it was touting a developing labor law midwinter meeting in St. Thomas, which kind of perked up my ears. And so I knew Jim Paris was very active in the ABA. And so I went to him and asked if I could go. And he said I could go, but I had to promise him that I will volunteer to do something. I can't just sit there. I have to make something out of it. And if I did, he would support me. So I went to this meeting. I didn't know anybody. St. Thomas was awfully nice. But they asked for volunteers at the end of the meeting as to who would volunteer to speak at the next meeting. So I did. I volunteered. And I did speak at the second meeting. I was like, these meetings are 3 days long. And I think I was on the panel on the third day, the very last one. But anyway, I must have done okay because I was asked to do it again several times. And I ultimately became co-chair of the committee. And then from there, I was elected to the ABA Labor Section Council for 2 4-year terms. And then after that, I was asked to be co-chair of the ABA Labor Section Publications Committee for 2 more years. So I did what Jim asked me to do. It probably helped that Jim was very prominent in the group, but I feel like I made my own way and I made the most of it.
You're still involved in the DLL, correct?
I am now. I'd stayed involved for a while after retirement, and then I let my ABA membership lapse. But I just re-upped it at the urging of a few long-term friends and veterans of the committee, and we're planning to what may be a last hurrah at the coming March midwinter meeting. Of course, the fact that it's in Kauai may have had something to do with all of this, but we're going to go there and show the flag and show that old labor lawyers never die.
Oh, that's great. When was the Palo Alto office of MOFO opened?
It was opened in the mid-80s, and actually our labor practice was a major reason it opened, although there were other reasons, but one of our labor partners went down there and was one of the key people in opening the office, and then I ended up moving down there a little bit later.
What caused you to relocate from the San Francisco mothership to the Palo Alto outpost?
Well, one, I had been reluctant to do it because I was chair of the group and I felt like I ought to be in San Francisco for a while. But by the late 80s, you know, we had labor practices all over the country, and our Palo Alto office was doing a booming labor business. And I also was living near there. I lived in Los Altos, still do, which was really nearby to the Palo Alto office. Most of my clients were down here, so I made the move and continued on as chair of the group, but it didn't make as much of a difference that I wasn't in San Francisco by that point.
You mentioned earlier that you had practiced law for over 40 years. What kinds of changes have you seen in the practice of law as a profession during your years?
Well, one thing is that it's gotten really big. I mean, I thought Pillsbury was too big when I was looking around after graduating because they had 100 lawyers. And by the time I retired, MoFo had over 1,000 lawyers all over the world. And as you, with growth like that, compensation and billing rates kind of go up together. And they really rose dramatically. So firms were becoming, including Morrison & Foerster, far more of a bottom line business than really is a profession, I thought. And this had a big impact on the labor practice because basically it was uneconomic. You couldn't have a labor practice and charge the rates that big firms needed to charge to pay the big dollars to the top partners. And employment law was viewed more and more as a commodity that, it was fine, but you couldn't charge $1,000 an hour to do it. And so the practice of labor law, kind of interestingly enough for me, began to gravitate back to what it looked like when I first got out of law school, because back then the big firms didn't really do it. There were some specialty firms that did, but most big firms didn't do much labor law because it was labor law, it wasn't employment law, and they didn't have a lot of union clients. And so I felt like when I retired, it looked a lot like it had when I came out of law school. True to form, most of the big firms, including Morrison & Foerster, have shed their labor practices, and you find labor lawyers on the management side now going to specialty employment firms. So where they can charge more reasonable rates, big firms will refer business to them. And it's kind of the world it was when I started out.
You were selected as a founding fellow in the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers. That must have been an incredible moment for you. Would you discuss with our listeners how that felt?
Well, it was great. When I was on the ABA Labor Section Council, as I mentioned, I served two terms there. We decided that it was time that we had something akin to the American Association of Trial Lawyers. Something similar for labor lawyers. And so, especially Steve Talent at Gibson Dunn, I'll give him a lot of credit. He was on the council at the time, but he pushed this idea. And so we formed the college. And I was fortunate enough, I guess I was in the right place at the right time, because I was fortunate enough to be inducted as one of the founding fellows of the college in 1996 because of my role on the council. And it has been a great honor, and it's been amazing to watch how it has grown now to what it is. It's a terrific and tremendous college. They have good events. They have an annual meeting. They do a lot of good things. So, but it's made really a big honor.
Were you involved in any pro bono work during your practice at MoFo?
I was, and my major pro bono clients were first the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, which is really my biggest and most rewarding pro bono client. And it allowed me to do traditional labor law because the Service Employees International Union, right after I started representing them, sought to organize the employees at the AIDS Foundation, which was getting bigger and bigger in San Francisco. And so I handled the election campaign, the board hearing, and then when we lost that and the union was certified, I handled collective bargaining negotiations for two different contracts for them. And I'm proud to say that I got such a good management rights clause that didn't require mandatory dues, that after about 3 years of losing money, the SEIU withdrew recognition. So that was one of my great successes for them. I also did work for the state bar. I handled their collective bargaining negotiations in 1986. And lo and behold, the state bar attorneys decided they would go out on strike, which made a lot of news. And we ultimately settled that. And then the other thing that I've done, that it's not exactly pro bono, but it was semi-pro bono. I got involved with the California court system through Bob Raven, who was chair of our firm at that time. And the Santa Clara Superior Court was having a problem with the county, because back then the county negotiated a collective bargaining agreement that purported to cover the court employees, and the court wasn't able to participate. And they said, well, we're not going to abide by the collective bargaining agreement. And so that led to litigation, and I handled the case and won it and established the principle that court employees are court employees. They're not county employees. And so that then led me to other court representations. And also it led to a government code provision in California, like a mini NLRA that just covers court employees. So very much like the NLRA. And so I ended up doing a lot of collective bargaining for courts like the Santa Clara, Sonoma, San Diego, Sacramento. I actually even worked for the California Supreme Court in drafting their personnel rules. So, and you couldn't charge. Basically, it was pro bono, but it was so much fun. I just loved doing it. Pro bono gave me a chance to do the traditional labor law that I wasn't getting able to do as much of as I had wanted before all of the wrongful discharge litigation started.
That sounds like fascinating work representing the court system.
It really was. It was kind of heady to go in. I'd meet with all the judges, and I would be introduced as their negotiator. And then I would tell them that they weren't to say anything about the negotiations other than talking to me. And so I was giving a lot of orders to the judges, which was kind of a role reversal. But it was really interesting and intense work, actually, because the funding for courts in California is, subject to the vagaries of the budget, so it can get hairy.
How important is it for attorneys to perform pro bono or socially beneficial work?
I think it's important. Most of us who have legal skills and are profiting from it, I think, have an obligation to give back by using those skills to help those who might not otherwise receive them. And of course, it's a personal issue, but that's how I felt. And then for me, pro bono was great because, and I think it is for a lot of people, I was able to take on work that I really like and take advantage of assuming responsibility at maybe a sooner point than you would otherwise. And so it really helped me develop as a lawyer. I mean, I learned as much, if not more, from that work than I did from the paying work.
Now that you've retired and have had, I'm sure, a great deal of time to reflect over your career, what advice would you give to young attorneys who are just starting their careers now?
Well, I would say this is probably self-evident from my description of what happened to me when I started out. Find a mentor. It's really key. I can't imagine how it has been practicing law in the COVID area where you weren't able to do what I did, which was tag along and all of that. But I would say get your fanny to work. Latch on to someone, if possible. Prove to them that you should get increasing responsibility and learn how to develop yourself in a way that gives you an opportunity to take on more and more work. In other words, watch what they do, prove yourself to your mentor or whomever you're working for, and then learn how to develop business. And for me, the Bar Association, ABA and things like that, pro bono work would do it too, is to get your name out there. And I don't know if the opportunities are quite as great as they were for me, but I try to make that happen.
That's very interesting advice. But have you ever asked that one question too many?
Well, Steve, I'm sure I have done that many times over my career, but fortunately, as you get older, you forget mistakes that you might have made. But I do remember asking one question too many in an unusual context. I was handling a termination arbitration, and the arbitrator was the iconic Sam Cagle, who was probably the lead arbitrator on the West Coast at the time. And the grievant had been fired for urinating in an area of the beet sugar plant where he worked. And he had denied it, but the company had a UV black light that would light up in the presence of urine. And they used that to show where he had been and used that as part of their termination decision. So the arbitrator, Sam Cagle, seemed very interested in this black light. And so my one question too many was, I asked him if he would like to take a look at the device. And he did, one question too many, because he turned it on and his pants lit up like a Christmas tree.
Oh, that's the best. That's the best answer yet. Ray, can you tell our listeners the best way of getting a hold of you?
Sure. I think email is the best. My email address is rwheeler, W-H-E-E-L-E-R, 1945@gmail.com.
Thanks for being on, Ray. This has really been wonderful.
I've enjoyed it, Steve. Thanks for having me on.